Back here on the Mighty 690, 743 here on the clock. And it is time for our Green Side Up program here on the Mighty 690. We have joining us in studio Wendy Powell, K-State Extension Livestock Production Agent. Good morning, Wendy. How's it going?
Great. How are you?
Doing well. So I know that I've been busy here with a few events. You got some that are coming up for us?
Yes. Aside from county fairs, right after the county fair wraps up here in Montgomery County, we're going to host a mortality management workshop in Parsons on July 29th. So that will kind of showcase an innovative way to take care of some carcasses and not dragging them out to the back 40, because that's illegal here in Kansas, but just a new way to manage those carcasses and mitigate that problem. So July 29th, the Save the Date information and flyers will be up pretty soon.
Fantastic. Well, it's a great opportunity there, so hope folks can get in on that. So here today, I was hoping you'd talk about it, and sure enough, you've got it. The big headline here, and I'm afraid we're probably going to be hearing about it for quite a while, mm-hmm. The New World Screwworm.
Yes. So New World Screwworm, a lot of folks have heard about this because it is an invasive species that has come across our southern border here in the United States, and it's going to affect our livestock industry. So New World Screwworm essentially is a fly. The screwworm refers to the larva stage of that fly. And the yucky thing about these guys is they feed on living tissue of warm-blooded animals. So usually livestock, wildlife, things like that, occasionally birds, even people, we're also warm-blooded. We tend to not have to worry about it too much because all of our wounds, we like to keep our eyeballs on, and we tend to keep an eye on those sorts of things. If there's something growing in there, then we're going to find it pretty quickly. So a few things to keep in mind to create less panic, hopefully. It's treatable. So there's no reason that we have to be scared of this. It's treatable. We can take care of it if it is found. And secondly, it does not impact our food supply. So it's not going to affect the meat industry. Any livestock that are infected are going to be quarantined. And there's a whole host of biosecurity practices that will be put in place. So we don't have to worry about our meat supply because this larva will only feed on living tissue. So with that being said, are there screwworms that feed on dead tissue? And indeed there are. So that is why KDA, the Kansas Department of Agriculture, has implemented a report mandatory of any screwworm activity. So if you see screwworms at all, maggots of any sort in live animals, you are supposed to report that. So just call your vet, call the extension office. We'll get you in contact with the local field representative for KDA. They'll have to come out and make for sure that it is either old world screwworm or new world screwworm. So there, like I said, it's treatable. There's no need to panic, but we do need to take precautions to make for sure that this guy is under control.
So what are we looking for when it comes to the actual screwworm fly?
Yeah, they're really distinctive. The adults they've got these orange eyes, and their body is kind of a metallic bluish teal color. So they do not look like a house fly. I'm not even sure that they're the same. They're a bit bigger than a house fly, and they're going to look completely different. They're going to look kind of weird with these orange eyes, blue teal metallic body, and they're not going to be swarming like what you see typically around cattle, like horn flies that kind of hover over the livestock to feed. These guys, whenever they're adults, they hide out in the shade. They like to do their own thing. It's only whenever they're ready to lay eggs, when the females are ready to lay eggs, do they go and find a host. So you're not going to find them just in swarms around the house, around barns, or anything like that. Secondly, what else are we doing, USDA, what else are we doing to take care of this problem? And have we had it before? and in fact, we have had in 1960s through a lot of different reports, we found that there's been quite a lot of activity. And the reason we got rid of it was because they were creating sterile flies in laboratories and overwhelming the wild population by releasing sterile males. So only the females lay eggs. They can lay 200 to 300 eggs at a time. And so anytime they mate with a sterile male fly, then of course those eggs are not going to be viable. They'll go ahead and lay the eggs, but they won't continue to develop. They'll be sterile. So that's the plan again. The labs that create those flies have been resurrected from the 1960s, being updated. There are some of those labs actually producing flies already, not at the capacity that we need yet, but you know, they're working on it and they're getting that job done. So right now what we're doing is rearing these sterile flies and asking any ranchers, anybody that is seeing screwworm activity, to go ahead and report that. So those are the big things right now.
So of course, I know that again, those plants are, you know, coming online, and some, I think there is going to be one opening early 2027, I think, mm-hmm. is the plan on that. But obviously it does take a little time. So, I mean, this started in Mexico. I mean, we've been sort of hearing a little bit about this for a while, but they could migrate up even to Oklahoma and Kansas is the thought, right?
Absolutely, yes. As our weather continues to warm up for the summer, these flies can migrate just on their own. In our wildlife as well, and in livestock transportation. So anytime that we're hauling livestock from one location to another, we're taking the risk of moving any sort of invasive species, just like with ringworm or any other disease. So we have that issue to keep in mind. So any area in Texas that currently has, and a case in New Mexico as well, any place that has these issues with this screwworm, they're under very strict guidelines as far as transportation. They have to get certified veterinary inspections in order to transport anything out of those areas. And that's not just the ranches that are involved. That's going to be the neighbors, the neighbor of the neighbors, things like that. There's a very strict transportation issues. And that's not to say that business is not continuing for those folks. It's just that there are certified vets out there taking a look at things and making for sure that nothing is moving out of those quarantine zones or zones of infection to carry this out of the population. So they are keeping a very close eye on this. And it has been an issue for a couple of years. So we've been expecting this to happen for, like I said, a couple of years coming across our southern border. It was just a matter of time.
So what does the life cycle actually kind of look like when we break it down?
So these adult flies will lay their eggs, and those eggs hatch in 12 to 24 hours. The eggs are laid in an open wound or mucous membrane. So like think teardrops, things like that, is where these maggots can be laid, where the eggs can be laid. And then the maggots will feed in those open wounds for 5 to 7 days on the living tissue, causing quite a bit of pain. So I can only imagine a living critter in there trying to harvest some living tissue. And everybody that has worked with these before in the 1960s clearly recalls a very distinctive putrid smell. They say that no one alive right now that has smelled this before. It's very different and putrid. So after that week of eating on the living tissue, they're going to fall off of the wound into the soil and burrow into the ground where they pupate, and then the cycle starts again.
Oh, that's fairly gross.
Yes.
But yeah, so something to be, again, looking for. And I know, you know, obviously for us around here, you know, the main thing would be, you know, the cattle and those impacts. But I mean, really, they're not discriminative when it comes to mammals.
Right. Nope. Any warm-blooded living tissue, they will go after. It's comforting to know that here in Kansas, our winters are too cold. So they're not going to overwinter here. Any issues that we have will be year to year. And we do have a different situation. Our wildlife population is different from the 1960s. Our transportation industry is different. So we have different, we have a different landscape from the 1960s. And so things are going to have to look different, but we're still taking steps to mitigate all of these things.
We're talking with Wendy Palak here from K-State Extension about the New World screwworms and anything else, Wendy, that we should know when it comes to this topic.
I encourage folks to look at the facts. The USDA is, they have this very nice website of where folks can go and monitor all of the different outbreaks. They update that daily. And if you're looking for information, look at the .gov or .edu websites. Try to stay away from folks' blogs or things that are not research-based. I've seen some posts where they'll put up a picture of a house fly and call it the New World screwworm fly, and that just terrifies everyone because we all see those. So just make for sure that you're looking at research-based information and know that it's not going to affect our food supply and that it's treatable and that it's not going to overwinter in Kansas. And so far there have not been any cases in Kansas. It's the southern end of Texas and then a case in New Mexico.
Very good. Well, we'll watch it as it does continue. Now, any other preventatives as we wrap up here that we should know about? Any other preventative measures here when it comes to this?
I always encourage folks to get out and look at their animals. So any wounds that you see, keep a close eye on them. Doctor them. Take care of business. Make sure that you are being a good steward of your livestock, and that's going to precipitate into prevention of this disease as well.
Very good. All right. Wendy Powell here with K-State Extension talking some New World screwworm. I want to remind you, if you missed part of this interview, you can catch it later on today up at KGGFradio.com under our KGGF Morning News interviews. On the way, we'll continue our green setup program here in just a few minutes. We have much more coming up as we continue. We're also going to have an update from the Coffeeville Chamber of Commerce. That's on the way at 9:10 here on the Mighty 690. But we'll have a check of our jobs report and news on the way here on KGGF. Back here on the Mighty 690, it is 8:10 here as we continue our green setup program. We have Wendy Powell, livestock production agent, and joining us now, we have diversified ag agent Dave Enrolling. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So, Dave in here, I know you wanted to talk about just a few topics here. This last segment, of course, we talked about New World screwworm, and going to switch gears just a little bit and talk about rabbits in the garden.
Yeah, so switching gears a little bit. So rabbits can be very cute, but they can sometimes also be very frustrating if you're dealing with them getting into your garden. And this could be a vegetable garden. It could also be a flower garden or maybe a flower bed. A lot of the normal vegetables that are commonly grown that we think about in a garden, like tomatoes, pepper, squash, cucumbers, typically rabbits don't bother those plants, especially once they get bigger and are well established. But if you're growing a big variety of different vegetables in your garden, you may come across some problems with rabbits. So there's a few different options for controlling rabbits in your garden. So the first one is fencing, and this can be often the one that's thought about first. And fencing for rabbits can actually be pretty quick and easy because it doesn't have to be super tall to keep them out. Nothing like it would be if we were trying to maybe keep deer out of a sweet corn patch. You do want it at least 2 feet tall for rabbits, and you want to use one of the very fine mesh fencings that is 1 inch squares or less, because rabbits are good about slipping through those really small spaces. And you can use electric fence posts to put up the fencing, or just some stakes. It doesn't have to be anything super heavy duty for rabbits. Another option, especially if you're dealing with plants that are smaller that are just starting to grow, is what is called a floating row cover. And it is just really lightweight woven material that can be placed over plants, but it still allows light, water, and air to come through. Most often this is used for early growth, kind of early spring, to keep plants warmer, but can also be used to keep rabbits out of your garden. And then of course there's repellents, and whether it's rabbits or other critters that are getting into people's lawns and gardens, this is probably the question that I get the most, is there just a repellent that we can spray to keep the wildlife away? And with rabbits, there actually is some repellents that are approved and have been proven to work to keep rabbits from eating plants. The problem with these is that they're pretty kind of short-lived, so you have to reapply them to the plants quite often. And then also you want to make sure to read the label very carefully, because some of these repellents aren't safe to use on our vegetable plants that we will be eating for food later on. So definitely make sure to double check those labels. And then another option that is fairly easy to set up in your garden is a motion activated sprinkler. And this can just be attached to a garden hose. You don't have to run a specific water line for it. And these just release a short burst of water once it senses the motion of that rabbit. So there's a few different options that you can consider and figure out which one would maybe be the best fit for your garden or your flower bed.
I like the sprinkler idea. Definitely seems like a good one.
Yeah, that one was one of my favorites. It seemed pretty easy to set up and pretty user friendly.
Now, are rabbits with a if you put up, you know, a fence of some kind, are they going to try to dig underneath it?
They can occasionally if they're really committed to getting in there. The fencing mainly makes it not as convenient because they tend to eat on plants out of convenience sake. Especially this time of year, we've had a lot of rain. There's a lot of stuff growing naturally. And with rabbits, when it comes to fencing, it doesn't have to be, you know, an electrical net fencing or anything like that to keep them out. Those we only really talk about when it comes to trying to keep raccoons out of your sweet corn, for example. Speaking of that, now's the time if you have sweet corn to be thinking about if you have had raccoon problems in the past, getting that electrical fencing set up around your sweet corn patch to start deterring the raccoons from visiting it now. It helps them know it's off limits versus putting it up, you know, right before that sweet corn's ready and trying to keep them out of it then.
Sure. No, that is a great reminder on that. I know that I've seen with like wood fences, like privacy fences, I've seen where the rabbits will nibble out the space between the boards so that they can get between different, different fences.
Yeah, they are kind of known for their nibbling or cribbing like that. And especially when it's like those wooden privacy fences, they're left up long term. So the rabbits kind of get to be, oh, like this is in the way of me like visiting the neighbors or this other part of the yard. So they can really work on creating that hole to slip through. So with your garden fences, if you get that wire mesh fencing, it's kind of not totally rabbit proof, but they won't be able to chew through it.
Sure. No, that is definitely a good reminder here. On that, we're speaking with the Davin Rolling here with the Wildcat Extension District. And Davin, are there any events or Wendy, either of you, that you have that are coming up you'd like to tell us about?
I don't have any specific events coming up. We do have summer interns again this year. throughout the Wildcat District, and they will be doing a lot of different youth programming this summer. I know right now they're working with different summer school programs, and they're also going to be partnering with some local libraries. So keep an eye out for those. I think after summer school gets done the end of this month, they'll start doing some programming that is open up to all youth across the district.
Very good. So that'll be good.
Yep. And July 29th, we are doing a mortality management workshop. This is livestock mortalities, and we'll be hosting that at the Parsons Research Facility.
Wonderful. Well, it's going to be a good event there, and I hope folks can get signed up for that if they're interested.
Oh, and one more thing that I thought about, kind of related to gardens, is this week our program assistant Debbie Steed is offering pressure canner testing in the Independence office. So if you're planning on canning any of your goodies that you get from your garden this year, it's really important to get your pressure canner tested. Even if you had it tested last year, even if it's a brand new pressure canner, you still want to go ahead and get it tested again this year just to double check, make sure the gauge is working correctly. And you can take it into our Independence office this week, and Debbie will test it for you. She also has dates for doing pressure canner testing at our other offices as well that are listed on our website. Or you can just give her a call at our Independence office to set up a time. That number is 620-331-2690.
All right. Well, fantastic. We appreciate all the good information there, and look forward to chatting with you ladies again next week. If folks do want to get a hold of you, let's run through those that contact information.
Yeah, so of course folks can reach us by calling any of the Wildcat Extension District offices. My home office is Altamont now, so they can reach me by calling that number, which is 620. I just blinked on the number, so six, I thought I had it memorized.
Altamont is 620-784-5337. I had that one memorized.
Thank you.
My home office is now the Fredonia office, and that phone number, because I have it here in front of me, is 620-378-2167.
All right, ladies. Well, we appreciate it. As always, look forward to chatting again soon.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. That is our update here from K-State Extension. And on the way, we do have open line in just a few minutes. We'll also talk with Candy Westbrook from the Coffeeville Chamber coming up here at 9:10.